everybody, I believe, knows what CCR is, but let me spend just one transparency on the basic. So what is CCR? Let me start from a simplified version of the classical Bell Edwards theory. Simple repetition, and I just cut it to the 80% contribution by using a single relaxation time. This is called also the toy model, not to be confused with the Bell model. Okay, so what CCR did by arguing about the continuous retraction process of the chain in the tube in a steady shear is that the frequency of renewal becomes the thermal frequency of renewal plus a convective term, and gamma dot xy is just the for the shear the value that this quantity takes in shear, and this is the classical relative velocity result first suggested by Doe himself. This is the order parameter tensor of the tube orientation, and there is an unknown numerical coefficient called a beta. What this term changes is the behavior for gamma dot going to infinity. In fact, if beta is zero, so if there is no CCR, the shear, XY component of the orientation and therefore of stress goes to zero, whereas for all positive values for beta, it goes to a finite value, which implies that for gamma dot going to infinity, that the shear stress reaches a plateau value, which is essentially the plateau modulus, where there is a small numerical factor less than one which depends on this value. And correspondingly, the viscosity becomes inversely proportional to gamma dot in that limit. And the good news is that this one is independent of molecular weight, as everybody knows, and therefore this limiting viscosity also becomes independent of molecular weight. And that was the thing that had been shown for a long time by many data. These are data, I believe, by Glessley on polystyrene melt, and there are similar data for solutions varying the molecular weight but not the concentration by weight, whereas if you change the concentration by weight you are changing the modulus and therefore the asymptotic behavior also changes. To be complete, it's not complete good news because the limiting slope is minus one, whereas this data systematically show minus 0.8, not quite minus one. So there is that discrepancy.
Is that from
Strachan,
the really old
lady?
Is that from 1960s from
Strachan? I forget. These are from Kelike. In Hamburg, this solution data, but the melt data I forget, but they are probably by Glessley, I suppose.
What was
the picture you had in your head when you wrote down the second equation? You have a cartoon.
This quantity here is the relative velocity of the chain within the tube. So that's the velocity by which the chain end retracts in the tube. But in sobering, the chains which form the tube get a constrained release. Okay, so it's the mean field, let me repeat again.
Yes.
Okay, here is your test chain and here is the tube. Now, because of the flow, the tube elongates and the chain does not, because there is no stretch. So the contour length of the primitive chain is a constant, okay? So you get a relative velocity which is given by this quantity. If you are talking of the chain end, this quantity is a reciprocal time. You have to multiply time length, which is one half the length of the tube. That's an absolute relative velocity at the chain end. You follow?
There's some assumption you're making about tube
No, only that the tube is essentially is only random. I mean, only that the tube can be calculated by the ensemble average. That's the only assumption which is here. Okay?
You could actually have whatever picture you like, as long as you end up with a time scale that goes like shear rate, inverse shear rate.
But I mean, to stay within the tube idea.
I think, yeah, this is very straightforward.
This is the relative velocity.
So S doesn't have gamma dot in it?
No, S is the orientation.
And it's not changing with time.
It can do it, sure.
This is a steady state. It certainly changes with gamma dot. Okay? But this measures the relative velocity times any length. It measures the relative velocity between the retracting chain and the tube.
The primitive pass and the tube diameter, everything else is independent of gamma dot.
Yes,
I understand that. Okay. So you're assuming that whatever equilibrium value of tube diameter or primitive pass and everything is, gamma dot doesn't affect it.
Right.
Okay.
And this is without stretching.
And it's also assuming no chain
stretching. No chain stretching.
Well, chain stretching is a separate issue from the other issues.
Okay. Yes.
Exactly. That's why I said also. Then it does affect those.
Yes, but that's
okay. And then the mathematical consequences are trivial.
And beta
means what? Beta is a numerical factor, because we don't know for each entanglement removed how much the chain would jump. So that's the numerical factor in front of you.
What does jump mean?
When one end retracts, some other chain is losing an entanglement. And it will make a jump. It will be reoriented locally. And we don't know the extent of that reorientation.
Just like constraint.
The picture here sort of is that you're losing constraints off the end of the chain.
I'm sure you're familiar with thermal constraint relief. This is the same thing, only that.
why are you adding it in time?
The units of time are here.
No, but why are you adding this thing to time? That's my question.
This is the frequency of thermal renewal.
Right. It's a mathematical approximation. It's not full Rouse constraint.
Well, that's my question. Yes. This is more like thermal adaptation.
That's right. If you take beta equal 1, if you take beta equal 1, which was in fact done by Mead, Larson, and Doyle a couple of years later, if you take beta equal 1, it's the same thing as double repetition.
So it's a convective tube dilation of convective spin. Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay.
So you're not including the modes of the chain in this transverse mode?
Absolutely not.
That comes later.
Yeah. Okay, so the consequences of this mechanism were nice, but they were bad news too. And what was certainly wrong with the basic idea? If you actually calculate for all gammas what comes out from this set of equations, you get an asymptotic plateau, but always coming from above. I shouldn't say always. For all values of beta less than 3, but nobody had the courage to assume beta equal 3 or larger. So for all sensible values of beta, of order 1 or even less, you get a maximum. And the maximum maintains the instability in the response. So the simple CCR assumption, although introducing an asymptotic plateau, which was nice, would still maintain a maximum, including the assumption beta equal 1 made later by Nick Larson and Doi. Now, Doi will speak later, so what they did was essentially, they added to this basic idea stretch and approximately also fluctuations, as well as assuming a binary interaction model, a double repetition model, and therefore beta equal 1. And in many relatively short chain, inclusion of stretch and fluctuation will destroy the maximum. But still it remained a conceptual problem that given a sufficiently long chain where the stretch time and orientation time are well settled, and where fluctuations become a minor correction, you would still have the instability, and there were no data even with very large molecular weight showing that instability. So we thought that maybe there was some missing physics in the basic model. And so we came out with some tiny bit of additional physics that, for lack of fantasy, we call CCR2. And I give the reference here because maybe is Giovanni and myself in German Magnetonic Fluid Mechanics in the year 2000. So CCR is given a chain with its entanglements, other chains in their retraction motion will remove entanglements. And that's CCR. What is CCR2? Convection does another thing. Convection increases the average distance between existing entanglements. So if this is your chain at a given time and you are flowing, the distance between, the average distance between two entanglements is always increasing. Now, CCR2 postulates that in the absence of stretch, so for relaxed chains, for values of gamma dot less than the reciprocal Rouse time, the extended primitive chains wanders laterally. It doesn't stay straight. There is no reason for that. And gets caught in new entanglements, partly removing the orientation. So CCR2 is not convective constraint release, but convective conformational removal, if you wish. Okay? But anyhow, the acronym is the same, CCR.
Can you
comment?
What's the reason why average distance, if you don't have stretch, what's the reason why distance between entanglements gets larger? Is it number of entanglements gets small?
No, because you are convecting the chains.
Yes.
And any segment which is embedded in the continuum will, on average, increase in length.
But if number of constraints stay constant, how can it
be? No.
They will be
the sliding of ends, right?
I mean, you have these two constraints. Now, these two constraints will be displaced further apart.
Yeah.
But new one will appear in the middle.
A new one will appear in the middle. Yeah. Now, it was the conventional wisdom was that the new one will appear in such a way that this will remain straight. Okay? Now, CCR2 assumes that this is not necessarily the case. This primitive chain can wander about and find new entanglements. Okay? So that's the idea behind CCR2.
Mike is bringing up his status, I knew he would, but it might help if it was just pointed out that if you map this process onto a Rouse tube model, then there's absolutely no distinction between CCR and CCR.
Yeah, in fact, what I'm saying is that
and it's the same. If they're the same process within the detailed balance.
Yeah, well,
wait, CCR is not Rouse tube. CCR is in the Once you remove the constraint, stress that disappears at point. There is no, it doesn't depend on chain length. It's completely.
Yeah, it's equivalent to the I mode of a Rouse relaxation. The I mode of a Rouse relaxation is local, right?
Well,
the way the CCR was originally implemented, it releases constraints off the end of the chain, basically.
Yeah.
Whereas when you add this new
idea... No, these are different.
You know, that's the middle of the chain.
I'm just saying to him that the removal of one CCR, the basic CCR, can also be incorporated into a Laos model as Tom did, because the local release of a constraint and therefore the local change in conformation corresponds to a high mode of the Laos relaxation of the tube. Am I correct, Tom, in saying that?
Yeah, I think so.
But there is a part of the stress, that is the post stress.
No, that's good.
Right. So this is an approximation. It's a high mode only approximation, and there are no modes, just as there are in two grounds.
Okay, so this is the idea of CCR2, which is, in this context at least, is different from CCR. Now, how to implement the mathematics of this idea?
Do you have a picture of what those red things are? Are they ends of other chains? Are they middles of other chains? What the...
It's convected material, I don't know. I mean...
Could be either, but in general, middles. It can be ends, right?
Yeah, yeah, because for a long chain...
You don't have enough ends to fit with such speed. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, your implicit assumption is that the tube diameter doesn't change with stress.
Well, that will be done in a moment.
Okay.
To do a quantitative theory, you have to make assumptions, as always. And let me present this little bit of quantitative theory. Initially, I'll forget of CCR entirely. Let me first develop mathematics which only takes account of CCR2. Then I add CCR at the second stage. So the assumption is that the elongated primitive chains only keep their affine orientation for a length A. All the rest goes random. Okay? So the translation into mathematics of this picture is that the affine orientation of the segment is only kept over a distance of order A. All the rest goes random. All the rest of this segment goes random.
For A is a constant now.
A is a constant. It's the tube diameter which is kept constant during flow. This is the equilibrium value. So that's the assumption. The elongated primitive chains only keep their affine orientation for a length A, per entanglement, per old entanglement, so to speak, and the rest goes random. Okay?
So in the other picture, only one part of it? Or?
Only one part per entanglement. I mean, in this picture, the old entanglements are blue. Okay? Each of them gives a contribution of the affine deformation for a length of order A.
Which is smaller than the distance.
Well, if you wish to think of it, it's A over 2 on this side, A over 2 on this side, and the rest in the middle goes random. Okay? But the basic idea is that you keep the memory of the affine orientation only for a fraction of that length, and I assume that the fraction is based on the equilibrium length A. That clear?
At equilibrium, this is the general assumption.
At equilibrium, there won't be this straining.
Right. There's no stretch. So this is equivalent to just saying constant tube diameter.
Constant tube diameter.
There's really nothing more than that.
No. So why that assumption immediately simplifies matter? Because the only thing you have to do, you have to count how many entanglements survive. So the you can calculate the orientation from the Toy-Edwards tensor, and in fact, in this assumption, it will be the independent alignment tensor, because the length is fixed to A. So you only have to keep the affine orientation of the... And the kernel of this integration over time is based on this function F, which is the fractional number of entanglements existing at the past time t prime, which have survived up to t in the S location. Because you have only to count how many blue entanglements are there. because the rest is random. And so F obeys the usual diffusion equation, the repetition equation, together with the convective term, which is how entanglements are convected away from the center towards the end of the chain, with the usual boundary condition, and V is k dot double dot S formally up to the that clear? Within the assumption.
Is the assumption reasonable?
Who knows? Who knows?
The tube is defined by a potential, right, for lateral excursions, and it seems like that potential should change when you.
Well, that's a different topic. That's a different topic. We are within the assumption that the tube diameter doesn't change. Okay.
In fact, you can trace all appearance of tube diameter, and you can include whatever model you want for the change of tube diameter. Right? So if tomorrow you'll tell me that tube diameter changed so and so, I can put it straight away in this model.
Yeah. Okay, that's a different topic.
Sorry?
This is an accounting of the entanglement. Okay. Now, this is the picture which includes CCR2, but not CCR. And let me repeat again what the picture is. Assume these are, now they have become red, but these are the blue entanglements. If at a certain time you had 8 entanglements, then convection stretches the primitive chain, and 4 of them fall off the end. Okay, so inside the chain you are left with only 4 of the original entanglements, and you are maintaining the affine orientation only for a length A for each, and the rest goes random. That's the physics which corresponds to this mathematics. That clear? Okay, but so far we have accounted of CCR2 without CCR. In order to account for CCR, to include CCR, we write the same equation with a different function, which is just the product of the old function accounting for CCR times the average of that function over the length. Because this function counts how many entanglements go out of the chain, drop off the chain, and so the average over the length of this function, these how many entanglements are destroyed, and that provides the CCR contribution to P.
Here it's rather explicit that this is a sort of double rotation.
Yeah, explicit. Because I am assuming, in fact, the assumption is written down here. The assumption is of binary contact, beta equal 1.
I think it's confusing to mix double rotation with binary assumption. Because double rotation says something more strongly than binary assumption.
Okay.
When constraint is released, then the stress is completely released.
That's what he's done.
So it's not assumption of binary, it's double rotation.
Yeah.
I would say it's much stronger assumption than double.
Yeah, it's written double. Similarly to double rotation. I'm not hiding anything. Okay, and now. If you substitute this into that by exchanging integration over S and integration over time, you can make it more transparent that we are doing double repetition. This will be double repetition and double convection because it's CCR plus CCR2. So that's why it comes this curve, no? And that's all. That's the story. Similarly to double. And we call it the double convection repetition moment.
Without flow, just looking at LVE, then
becomes double repetition.
There's no difference.
Because you get the square of the function, which describes diffusion only.
Yes.
So it's double repetition. Okay,
it's very similar to what they did.
You did something similar without CCR2, without CCR2.
Without CCR2, that's right.
I'm about to conclude, because I'm not talking of the inclusion of stretch, which is, I don't think I have the time, so we'll do that in some other occasion, if at all. Just to conclude, I mean, everyone is familiar.
Does this resolve the
maximum? Now, probably many of, especially the chemical engineers, because this is the book by Bert, are familiar with this drawing showing data of various polymers and the Diagoras prediction, which fits beautifully up to this point, but then fails after this point. And without adjustable parameter, except all the assumptions that I have clearly illustrated, so no beta 1, but the inclusion of CCR2, this is what you get. The beta are the same.
Why do you get this? I mean, I'm surprised that you are not changing this Q tensor.
Essentially,
you just square it.
That makes the
trick. Okay, that's so the essential realization time.
But can you say that effectively increase beta?
Yeah.
If you increase beta, can you fit your new curve?
That will come in a moment. If you increase beta, you have to go above 3.
Yes.
Now this, double repetition, double convection idea corresponds essentially to beta equal 2, because you make convection count twice, right? But the beta equal 2 doesn't destroy the maximum completely. The rest comes from the distribution of S by the harmonics of the diffusion equation. In fact, this is the result that you get from that little mathematics I've shown before. Without any maximum and without any adjustable parameter, you get a function which is entirely monotonic and becomes a horizontal plateau somewhere here. Okay, up to here is completely monotonic.
No stretch,
absolutely no stretch in this theory. However, if you reduce to it to a toy model with the T, which means the single relaxation time without the diffusion equation, then you get this curve, which if you look at it doesn't seem to have a maximum, but if you look closely, it has got a maximum here.
It can be fixed by changing beta 20%.
Well, that's a trick, though.
But do you believe in precision of your model?
No, I don't. But what I want to stress is the following. This result was obtained with CCR2, but also, let me say, with a spread of times, a minimal spread, because only that resulting from repetition was sufficient. However, if you stay to one relaxation time, it's much harder to get rid of the maximum, which perhaps might explain why Wormalike myself, which are Maxwellian most of the time, they have a single relaxation time because of kinetics, do seem to show an instability, which polymers don't. So I'm not affectionate to any precise number, but I want to emphasize that while getting rid of the maximum is a relatively simple affair, without stretch, and without fluctuations, is a relatively simple affair in polymers, it remains hard for a single relaxation time model. Is that clear?
Yeah.
And I would stop here.
Why do you call this CCR2? Why?
Well, essentially,
what's the difference? I mean,
well, in the sense that they are both due to convection.
Yes.
But whereas CCR proper is an infield effect on the given chain, because it's the other chain moving away from the given chain, CCR2 is within the given chain. The given chain elongates its segments, and because of that, removes part of the orientation.
Okay, yeah, well, okay, so the reasoning is slightly different here, okay, but yeah.
But really, it's based on
But not about the relative motion. So they are not convective. Again, I am not hiding anything.
So one is at the kink in the chain, another one moves away, ping, it goes flat.
But that's physics, is not that physics.
The fact now, that physics is not in the simple CCR. That physics is that things are removed, and so you can remove orientation locally. But here, without removing anything, just because these things are elongated, without any removal, you are still removing, you are also removing the orientation.
The simple CCR, removes constraints off the interview chain. It doesn't allow for any intermediate adjustment phase.
That's the difference.
Can I ask another question about this below and that picture? I'm a little bit confused. What is the source of turbulence on scale smaller than distance between blue one? So it looks like you are randomizing and hanging. If I view this flow, which is a fine motion of all chains sideways, how do other chains manage to add entanglements in a random way to randomize the chain at the same scale?
These are the old entanglements which are separated along.
Perfect.
Now, the primitive chain here can now wander a little bit.
But that's my... Yes.
Okay. Now, because there is a relative motion, there is a flow, something can enter here.
Well, so you're talking about the hands only. We need hands.
If you have a long loop in some chain which enters there, it creates an effective entanglement, doesn't it?
No, not on long time scales, but you have ends.
Well, but you don't need long time scales because you are controlled by CCR.
It will not give you, I don't think it will give you a topological, long-lived topological constraint unless you have other chains. Turbulence-like motion, like eddies moving in and randomizing your contour of your...
You
see what I'm saying?
You need to specify the time scale with the chain delta minus one, that's all.
Pardon?
The time scale is not the
time scale, it's gamma delta minus one.
You are in a regime.
You need both turbulence, otherwise you will not... Or ends.
There's no stretching in this, but also... In order for this process to take place, you have to have, essentially this works up to some Rouse time, right? I mean, this
is true.
After that, the Rouse time, then you have to have stretch. We are unable to have stretch to this fundamental. The Rouse time is also relevant to this wriggling that you're...
Rouse time will not add a new entanglement in the middle of between the old one. You need to have
When you stretch the chains, the picture changes completely, in my opinion.
You don't know. In a steady state, you don't know. But my idea is just to thank, let's illuminate our discussion.
Okay, this is a continuation of the previous discussion. I didn't think that I was supposed to give anything about the convective constraint release, I think, but the history, I want to say something about the history of convective constraint release. And I very well remember that you gave a talk of the convective constraint release at the Sam Edwards meeting. Mm-hmm. I think it's long, it's 96. I must confess, I did not understand the whole idea. It took so long time, and David Milik was in my lab, and he graduated, taught me the concept, best concept of the convective constraint theory. This is really a very straightforward thing, and woke me up. And then CCR2, now I begin to realize that, we did not talk, but the past has some aspects of the CCR2, although we did not realize it anyway.
Sam himself claims that you and he, in the late 70s, you knew all about this.
Because the Duesenoibus model, you looked at it, you realized that it was a nightmare you didn't want to have anything to do with, and left it because there was a simpler thing to say.
I don't think that I know. Well, some may have noticed. Alright, so this is a continuation of my previous talk with Pasta, but I think this is an implementation of what Pino, computational implementation of what Pino talked and what I think the current understanding of, current modeling of the reputation is doing in a simple way. So we model the entanglement by this way, but in Pasta, well, we did not take this, and as I said, we did not take a real an entanglement as Pino is doing in Naples, but rather we took a very these chains move independent. These chains are moving in some slippings, and these slippings are fixed in space and deforms affinity. I want to be a bit more specific about that, because this is the dynamics of the primitive bus implemented in Pasta. Well, by the way, I have to say that this program was developed by Takimoto-san, and okay, in this implementation, you only the single chain is represented by a set of these slipping points. And the state of the polymer is represented by the contour lengths, big L, and only the longest relaxation time of the fluctuation is taken into account. And we are going to see simulate the time evolution of this primitive path for taking into account of these things, flow and contour length, relaxation and reputation, and some just and consonant degrees.
Now wait, do these slip links move, or they
fit
back?
They fit, yeah, they deform fine, yeah. Right.
But can I repeat about primitive chain path? How many, and do you simulate Rouse chain inside the slip link?
We'll come back to that point. It's basically a dumbbell.
That's right.
It's a simplified version of the Jay Shiba's and model. I think. Yeah.
Is the number of monomers between links a variable, and can that fluctuate by shuffling?
Well, in this, we are assuming that it is always the number density is uniform. So it may change. It is dictated by the contour lengths L. The number density is dictated by contour lengths, but we do not take into account of the non-uniform.
Higher modes are not considered.
Yeah, higher mode is not considered.
And the length is fixed throughout. Length does depend on
ground. Length does depend. Length may change. Length, yeah, varies. We want to,
Length between the slip lengths.
Slipping and the total contour length also changes. First step is to apply. Okay, so I'm talking about some time evolution of the system in a time small time step delta t. First, we change everything affinity, and this certainly changes the contour lengths L to some big numbers.
So, as a practical matter, the end of the chain is also in this step, mu affinity.
That's a small point. I can't answer quite precisely. Okay, I don't think that they do. Just a summation of these things. Okay, so if we deform these points,
right? But as this
point,
what happens to that part? Yeah,
these are stretchable segments.
I don't know. I can't answer to that question.
Stretchable segments between the links, all
right? That's right, yeah.
But the equilibrium L, it was relaxed, even the steady state will be the bare L.
What I'm saying is that this model can cope, can deal with this stretching. So we have some just some rings, and we have just a rubber band there, and it stretches.
The equilibrium length of rubber does not depend on gamma.
The contour length changes, but the we assume that the equilibrium length does not change. That's right. Okay. And so there is a relaxation. Okay. The relaxation is taken into account. Yeah. Okay. Okay. I should have taken this. This we assume this equation, and this Eric is assumed to be independent of gamma dot. Yeah. Okay. This was your point.
Constant tube diameter.
Constant tube diameter. Okay. And then adaptation time, and then some fluctuation. And then obviously the adaptation, the slide tree. And then the creation and destruction of the three things. Now, we traced the pairing process on a tree. So each strip ring has its partner. But the partner is chosen when new strip rings is created, and the creation of strip rings is done when the length of this end segment becomes larger than the entanglement test A, which is assumed to be constant. So if we have this situation, we have slip ring here, and then this slip ring has to look for its partner. So we select the sub-chain randomly according to the lengths of the with the weight of the lengths of the chain.
Middle of the chain can become entangled with another middle of the chain.
Yeah. Only the end can entangle, but the partner can be found anywhere. Yeah.
And the location of that new slip link in the middle of the partner is chosen how?
Okay, yeah. So that's an artificial pattern. That's a delicate point. And here we did that. There are several versions. And I think what we did finally that we decided that we make it at the middle of the chain, and then assume some distribution function. The Gaussian distribution function for the lengths, and the width is determined in such a way that we calculated how much stress relaxation will take place when you create. We use the Cramer's formula for the stress, and we can calculate the stress relaxation in this state, the stress contribution of this segment, and stress contribution of that segment. We chose the parameter, the Gaussian parameter, so as to minimize the difference between them. In other words, that we chose the parameter in such a way that creating a new slip ring does not induce any stress change. Although we can't do it perfectly, because there's some stress change, but we minimize it.
Does this give the right static statistics for the random walk?
In what sense? I mean, at least for the entry and vector.
The contour length is fixed, I guess.
Contour length is not, well, it's fluctuating. It is fluctuating because we are introducing this in a random force. Yeah. And it doesn't obey. Okay, so in equilibrium, yes, it's a contour length. This is fixed. The distance between the entanglement point is. Well, actually, it is not fixed, because of this process, yeah.
So, can you explain much more
you create a segment that's longer than A,
mm-hmm.
and then that segment you declare needs a new slip length.
Right.
You establish that by looking for the nearest end.
No.
What's the second?
It's
just all by itself.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine. All right. I just didn't understand.
Yeah.
So what is the distribution of the?
Of this length. Okay, it is not
the. Is this bare A? What is the root mean square fluctuation of this length? Is it?
This distance.
The new one, the two new ones.
I mean, these
two ones are equal, right?
Yeah. Huh?
The two new ones are equal because it's the middle point.
It is.
Displaced middle, but how much is displaced?
So that is.
According to that view, it does matter.
Yes.
I mean, there would be other alternatives. You might want to replace it with a Metropolis algorithm and a Boltzmann weight. You chose not to do that. You chose a stress rule.
So you're restricting the fluctuation, or is it normal fluctuation?
Yes. In this case, so that's quite artificial.
Which
Gaussian?
Of that segment,
this segment. Yes. So we place this points in the plane that is by intersect of this segment.
Right, but then in the absence of flow, wouldn't this create a problem? If you don't have flow, you would not get the. I keep doing this, you will not reproduce back original two.
That's right. This length, there is some distribution of this distance. Yeah.
So you create two slip links simultaneously in some sense. You create one in the middle of this
mm-hmm.
round chain.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of understand where you put that one. What about the one that you create at the other chain? You create it right at the end, or what do you do?
Well, here, yes. It's you create here. You create the point at the point that the.
Displace it by A.
By A. Yes, that's subtle point, and we only took a statistic. So the distribution of the So the distribution of this is not A is not constant. Right? So A is a parameter. It's a parameter, and actually the length of the segmental this length of subchain has some distributions even in equilibrium. Yeah.
If I remember right, I'm talking to Takimoto-san.
Yeah.
That distance you go from the middle, he basically adjusted that to try and get the right equilibrium statistics that he wanted for the random walk.
Uh-huh. Okay.
He wasn't sure where that number came from, but he knew what it had to be in order to.
Oh, to get that. Okay. Then
that's not the
direction.
What the number came from?
But okay, I just gonna show you some of the slide. That's for the steady shear flow, 3.4 power law, and that's about it. As Pino's, this model is I think very much like this computational implementation of CCR2, and I think yeah. So then, I think that many results agrees with the prediction, with the calculation of the CCR 2.
What are the units of shear stress? Is it Plato models?
Pardon me? It is. It's a steady state shear rate. I think that normalized by GN 0. Yeah.
That means that your shear stress is factor of 10 smaller than Plato models.
That's
not Plato models. That's 3KT divided by. I mean, it misses the factor that comes from the two tensors.
Okay, so again,
not
I'm.
Not Plato. Might be Plato.
I'm sorry. Okay. I think so. That's the second normal stress difference is it's slightly different from the first normal stress difference is the. Of that.
For instance, you've only got one mode
for the contour length fluctuations. Mm-hmm. And that's sufficient to get the 3.5 power law for M0?
well, you can choose a constant.
Constant.
Right. To the strength of this one mode for contour length fluctuations. Can adjust the contour, the strength.
So this is a delicate point, but yeah, okay. Because
it's the Rouse time, right?
But the constant should take into account this higher mode. But I think, but now here we are taking into account this double reputation stuff, so that may affect the number. Again, the comparison is tracked on the data. This is a diffusion constant. Okay, one can calculate the diffusion constant, and it shows the deviation from the reputation. Okay, now, previously we were not happy, but now we are happy.
So, Jim Lunch's paper came out during
Yes. And the origin of the departure we found is basically due to the constraint release.
You say contour length
fluctuations
is not enough.
No. Yeah. Well, at least our simulation, well, this implementation of the past, yeah, show that.
But in other simulations, more than enough. Like Deutsch, 8 to 9, you have 2.5 and just contour length.
Uh-huh. Oh, contour length.
Only, without any constraint release. And everybody else since then, you get minus 0.5 without any constraint release.
Contour length fluctuation.
Exactly.
Okay. That's for the chain in a fixed network?
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
But I guess the Milner-McLeish theory is based on just contour length fluctuations, and that
well, in this case, it's Milner and Fishing, as well as diffusion.
For diffusion, yeah.
Mm. Well, okay. Now this I am not quite an okay. Notably,
you can have your points, your slip links are drifting apart and slow.
Yes.
And you're only adding new slip links due to the end.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you assure that the average distance between slip links will not keep increasing forever? And you will eventually end up with no slip links at all if you have very long molecular weight and no ends.
Yeah.
You understand my question?
Yeah, I understand, yes.
I'm going to the case where there are very few ends, and if you don't do what Tina just did and added them due to middles, is your algorithm
I think the one thing is that we are seeing we are forcing that the contour length is is fixed.
Yeah, I understand that.
I'm
talking about number of slip links per chain.
Right. Okay. In equilibrium. Okay. Well, one can resolve that problem by saying that.
In fast four, does decrease? Can you check this?
We can if we take this point in this way in equilibrium simulation, okay, so it is possible to
I'm talking about flows where uh-huh. you're stretching distance between slip links is increasing, the contour length stays constant, so you're putting more and more length between a pair of neighboring slip links along
mm-hmm,
the two.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't add new slip links fast enough because you don't have enough ends, because you have n of any slip links,
mm-hmm.
but only two ends.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if only the ends would add slip links,
mm-hmm.
you would, in a, say, elongation of flow,
mm-hmm.
would end up after, before you reach steady state, would end up with no slip links at all.
If I may contribute to this discussion, you'll reach a situation where you have only two slip links at the ends, because there will always be, because the end always hooks something, and in the middle will be straight. But that would correspond to having so many slip links which are just inactive. The stress will be the same as having as many slip links you like, but on the same line.
Is good. quite the same, because you're in the model you're talking about.
Yeah, it's not disordered. It's not disordered.
Chain is assumed to be completely free between the slip links.
Without stretch.
Without stretch.
Without stretch.
And so you is having a narrow tube equivalent of having no tube at all?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
Because if you have two, you allow lateral fluctuation.
Yes,
you do, because next slip link is added. You take your middle of your distance between slip links, and you allow to add next slip link anywhere within a Gaussian distance.
If there is no stretch, because if there is stretch, it will only deviate marginally, because it wants to maintain the stretch. Is that right?
Well, I think if the repetition is taking place, I think once you get this configuration, there's some deviation of this scene. And as long as you have an, this is not, as long as you have some slippings in between, I think you.
But as you keep elongating, they will disappear eventually, and you will end
up forward. Two at the end, and two on average coming from other guys' ends, right?
Okay, but that will be independent of molecular weight, which is a little bit unphysical.
Independent of molecular weight.
Which is a little bit unphysical, is it?
Yeah.
Well, that's in the correct picture.
These are the active slip leaks. There might be others, but they don't care.
Are you relying on repetition to get the end far enough away from the last slip link to make a new one? Or would there be motions that would lead to the creation of slip links at the end without reptation, just by convection? I mean, it seems if the rings are sliding off the end and the chain is stretched out to some factor bigger than its usual length, then the rings are farther apart because the chains perform that finely, and then you lose a ring off the end, but you get another one right away again because the section between the end and the last ring has big enough length to put one in by your rules. We were sitting here talking about whether or not if you get above gamma dot tau rep equal to one, and rotation is in some sense not as important, whether there's any source for making any rings at all, since they're only created at the end and only if the end segment is long enough to justify it.
You can just check the simulation of the number of siblings.
I take that point,
My prediction is that this algorithm will give you four or whatever small number.
I take that point, okay. indeed, we have some problem in this, and high shear rate and viscosity. I think that your point may resolve that.
Concrete comment in support of what Pino said. If you calculate the stress by taking a tension times a length UU, then it doesn't matter how you divide up the length, as long as you can maintain an equilibrium tension.
That's my point.
Yeah.
The same as inactive slip.
Yeah.
But that 4 would be more or less independent of gamma dot, which is a little bit strange.
The Y component is essentially fixed as long as there is no stretch.
The whole system at rotation time. Okay? You almost get rid of all entanglements at rotation time, which is not physical.
The active
Active.
We don't care about inactive.
When the tube is essentially oriented,
that's exactly the same thing. But the main idea of CCR is not oriented, because you remain
fine. So we only 4 entanglements because it deviates sideways somewhat. According to the Gaussian or some similar rule, you still have a Y component which remains there all the time, and it's always the same.
But you can reduce the argument that you can put any many inactive entanglements as a straight line, because you're saying that it's not a straight line.
without stretch.
Even if the reduction isn't active here, he still does have one mode of controlling fluctuation, which would also give him the mechanism for making the end segment longer, and therefore long enough to have a
but mean, yeah, but that means you have some entanglements at the ends, but not in the middle.
Also
in the middle, the other chain end will look in the middle, that didn't get it.
But if you have all the four entanglement fluctuation, it kills them, it draws time.
Let's continue, yeah. I think, okay, that's all right, yeah. Yeah, okay. Just to show that this, master can cope in, well, it includes this and constant entities, so it can, the shear viscosity, star polymers. Well, in the implementation of star, we just assume that the central point does not fix in the current implementation. And then we have not yet computed this numerical factor in this simulation, okay? in the past time. Okay. I thought I have one. And also it has some. I lost one. Basically, for a given molecular weight, it can take some molecular weight distribution function and then just create many chains and do simulations, and it can predict some of the linear viscoelastic behaviors. And also it can, I think we have some simulation results for the linear viscoelastic part, some tube dilation effect is also taken into account, but I can't find it here. Anyway, that's about, I used up, overused my time.
Actually, we overused it.
Okay, thanks, Vincent. Yeah, I think we'll do, because this discussion is about how many entanglements, siblings, what cubes are doing, we're gonna be involved with our. We'll go straight on to Richard. Now, I think what we'd best do, rather than haul over the what happens to some things.
So the number of slip link decreases, yes, at high shearing, yeah, that's right.
It's
so
some kind of
discussion. The question is how catastrophic
we use. Okay.
How serious, how strongly it does.
So this is Richard Graham, for those of you who haven't met him. He was finishing his PhD in genes, but working transatlantically with Alexei Mendeley and with Scott in Exxon. And so this was a latecomer to the CCR enterprise, indicated one that tried to work with a picture similar to Rouse 2 for spent release in linear flow, then I'll leave Richard to explain the rest and to update you on where we are.
Yeah, that's you.
Okay. Thanks. I'll put this on and I'll leave you to deal with the other one. You're on.
Thanks.
So thanks a ton for the introduction. I'm Richard Graham and I'm a PhD student. Some of you might be wondering who I am and more importantly, who do I think I am? So I've put my web address here so if you want to find out a little bit more about me and what I've done so far. Quick outline of what I'm going to talk about. It's following on from what Professors Noriechi and Doi talked about. I just want to show, firstly, an overview of different ways of deriving these models and hopefully showing the distinction in the approach that we've taken. Then I'll talk specifically about our Leeds model, show you how we actually solve the model, obtain the parameters from linear ELG, and then go to a comparison with some experimental data. Quick summary of what we do and don't know at the moment, and then finally I'm going to pose some questions to you guys because I don't think it's entirely reasonable that I should be stood up here trying to answer everything when everyone else is out here. So I expect that most of you are familiar with these processes, but I just wanted to put a summary of the processes that we feel are important for capturing the nonlinear rheology of linear polymer melts. Some of you may recognize these diagrams. So we've got the classic reptation, retraction, which may or may not keep the chain at its equilibrium then, and constraint release, which we've already heard quite a lot about. So this is how I see the overview of methods for deriving these constitutive equations. I mean, we can sit and argue about the physical assumptions, but I'm going to say ultimately you've got to at some point get down to a comparison with experimental data. It's probably the only way I feel to justify the physical assumptions is, do they work with the data at the end of the day? So one way to do this is say, okay, I know what the processes are. I can assign time scales to these processes, so I'll go straight to a constitutive model and compare with the experimental data. Now, I would say you've made uncontrolled mathematical assumptions in going from here to here. So even if you do get agreement with or without parameters, can you really say, therefore, my physical assumptions are justified? So the approach that we've tried to take is to write down a localized equation, Langevin type equation, which captures our physical assumptions. Solve this by a series of closure approximations, and from this way, derive a constitutive model. And then that allows us to make a data comparison. So I feel there are two questions here, is how good are your physical assumptions, and also, how good are the mathematical approximations that you've used to derive the model? And I think you need to get both of those right in order to have a successful model. So that brings us to this issue of closure approximations and exactly how do you deal with these? And one way that we're looking at the moment is to do a combined approach using some stochastic simulations to either verify or improve the approximations that we've used in deriving the model. I've drawn this as a dotted line because this is work in progress. Alexei has done some simulations in some situations to check the closures, but not all of the approximations that I'm going to show. So I'm talking now specifically about the model that we've been developing in Leeds and in collaboration with Scott Milner. I think the physical picture is fairly clear. We have a polymer chain inside an entanglement network. We're going to allow it to shuffle along its own length by reptation. Chain ends that escape are free to choose an isotropic distribution. Any increase in the length of the contour relaxes by a Rouse-like retraction, which acts along the tube contour. And finally, we're going to allow the tube to make localized hops due to the removal of constraints. So for each of these three processes, we put a term in the Langevin equation. So starting with the simplest, which is reptation, to start with, we took the term directly from the Doy Edwards model. On top of that, we added the retraction term, which is essentially the term for a free Rouse chain but projected along the tube contour. So we're saying that the retraction force is proportional to the curvature of this chain, but only the we're only interested in the component projected along the tube tangent. And also this should act in the tangent direction. And then because there's no reason to believe that these are going to be unit vectors, we just normalize this quantity out.
Is it a straight tube assumption or your...
No, it's curved tube. That's why we need to project it along the tube tangent.
But the spin constant is
straight. Well, this score, I think, is one-dimensional straight tube.
No. This R is vector.
R is vector, but you're projecting on a straight tube to solve it.
We are projecting it on local tangent direction. In each point, the projection is different.
But you're not allowing projection to change your information.
We're saying that instantaneously at any point there's a force due to the spring force from the neighbours, which is this the curvature, but that we're only interested in the component along the tube because any lateral motion is forbidden by the entanglements.
This term plays an identical role to the K double dot S relative velocity of the tube and chain term in the global theory.
Another question. The equation, which you've got written here at the bottom, is an algorithm for a computer code.
Yeah.
And it implies, we like to think of it as a logical equation.
I know that you do, and that's the point of my question, is that this is an algorithm, right? And it implies some underlying mathematical expression. And so my question is, what is the equation that underlies? Is it a stochastic partial differential equation? Or is it a stochastic differential equation?
That's
the underlying equation.
This equation is stochastic partial differential equation, but it has to be given with quotient. And the quotient is, it has to be coarse-grained up to tube diameter. You can't resolve details smaller than tube diameter.
Which then turns it into a stochastic ordinary differential equation.
As an array of stochastic ordinary. So this can be used as computer algorithms straight away, but the equations which Schitcher will show later can be.
That's because of the assumption that R is a smooth continuous curve?
Yes, but it can be treated like a nice can be acting on any point. You have to cause grain
to turn it into a stochastic differential equation.
So,
since we've spent sort of endless time discussing the models which are not as microscopic as this, and basically zero time discussing this model, it might be just as well to let Richard go on and tell the story with fewer interruptions than we've had here before.
What was the point?
I think we should shut up and let him tell this, since we haven't talked about this approach previously in the meeting.
But don't we want to understand the starting equation before we saw this result?
Yeah, I think we want to spend time on this equation.
The term that Richard hasn't talked about yet.
So is there a term includes the, if you have a tension, is the allow primitive path to change due to tension or not?
What do you mean?
Well, if you have a some flow and there is a it is a tension that you are allowing the primitive path to deform due to tension, or are you forcing it to be more or less along a given?
Yeah, this term seems a fixed tube. It's the blue term, which takes into account the deformation.
Oh, constraint release. I'm talking about without constraint release. If you increase in tension, do you allow the primitive path to deform due to tension or not?
No, not without constraint.
So it's a straight tube.
Yes, in this sense, it's
It's a fixed primitive path. It's not a straight tube.
It's a straight tube because you don't have to solve the equation to allow the tube to relax.
It's a kind of straight.
it's a straight tube model.
And
I mean, perhaps the answer is it's going to have fine length deforming too, insofar as that goes. The term doesn't have a colored box around, it tells you how the tube moves if nothing else happens.
Right, but it doesn't respond to force
locally. Well, yeah, it assumes that the density is uniform and perpendicular.
You have pre-averaging, so you have pre-averaging force. Actually.
You can't cut angles.
That's right, that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. It doesn't cut angles.
Yeah, it doesn't.
And then finally we have a term which has it gives the tube browse-like motions due to constraint release. In deriving this term, we asserted that we assume that there's a given constraint release frequency. How does the tube react to this frequency? We know the frequency of hops, and we also know the distance. It's related to the tube diameter, and so there's a derivation which produces this term. And
what's this function G?
G is the it's the noise due to constraint release. In the model, when you remove a constraint, the bead has a choice whether it actually takes the hop or ignores it, and that's a random process.
They look very like, in fact, almost exactly like terms in the ordinary Langevin equation for a Rouse plot, of course.
Yeah.
You might even call little g CCR2.
You might.
And nu is just number?
Nu is the frequency of constraint release, which we...
A single frequency. But it's a function of
the... Which...
It's determined self-consistent.
I think which determines that.
Yeah, the nu is the constraint release frequency, which we assume at any given time there's a single rate, but we find that rate at each time step self-consistently from the retraction rate of the chain. So the way that we get at physical quantities from the Langevin equation is by taking some averages of the equation, and the function that we choose to solve for is this tube tangent correlation function, which tells you how correlated is the tangent vector at one point with the tangent vector at a different point along the chain. And the reason for this is if we know everything about this function, we can then fairly easily compute the stress tensor, single chain structure factor, and hopefully many other things as well.
How hard would it be to get DRDS to describe dielectrics scattering?
Is it at the same time?
The point with the dielectric stuff is that you need a correlation at different times. So we don't have that at the moment, but it's not a huge step, we don't think.
Is this normalized with this is the RDS is very normal?
No, it's not normalized, so the length gets longer when the chain stretches. So I'm just going to work through how we derive the contribution to the change in this function from one of our processes. I'm just going to take you through the mathematics. The reason being that I want you to see the points at which we need to use the closure approximations. For a couple of reasons. One of them so that hopefully you appreciate why, given our current formalism, we need to use them. And secondly, to maybe stimulate some discussion on in which situations they might be valid and reasons why they might not be. So what I've done here is switch this tensorial value of F into Cartesian components. Alpha and beta denote the Cartesian components, and taking the time derivative, because ultimately we want to write down a time derivative equation for this quantity, and then shuffled the order of the differentiation, essentially just moving these two points to the outside, and applying the product rule. Now I'm going to focus on this term. If I can produce an expression for this term in terms of F, then I can just produce a symmetric version, and that's take care of the whole thing.
So again, just shuffling around the order of differentiation, I can see that this dr by dt, I have an expression from the Langevin equation. So this thing here, I can just plug directly from the Langevin equation. And this example, I've included only the CCR term. That's one of the ones that works nicely. Taking the expression from the Langevin equation for this, putting it inside here, and then averaging the whole thing. Then by, again, reordering the order of differentiation, I can produce a closed expression in terms of f. So of course I've chosen the case where we don't need to use a closure approximation. But you can see that, for example, if I needed to put a more complicated...
You decouple frequency of constraint is from R. So where is
proportion?
It's
called
closure. So you decouple frequency of constraint.
New outside.
New, you take new outside.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, but that is
closure. That's minor, but it's minor. But, no, it's minor closure.
Yeah, it's minor in some points, but it's not minor.
Yeah, no, that's true. It could be.
Okay, but by assertion from the start, this, we weren't coupling this to the coupling it to the chain conformation anyway.
No, that assumes that frequency of constraint is the same for every.
We were
willing
to take that as part of your model.
Yeah, I was.
No, but it can be changed.
We'll talk about this later.
Yeah.
So anyway, then you have to repeat this process for all of the other terms that we have in the Langevin equation, and so. If the function that comes from the Langevin equation is anything more complicated than this, then you've got to, in order to make this final step and get the whole thing in terms of f itself, you need to start splitting some of the averages up. So I've tried to summarise the whole process here, starting from the Langevin equation, repeating the process that I outlined here, and eventually coming down to, well, I've written this equation as a expression for G, which is just F with an isotropic chain subtracted off. And it turns out that we need to use two closures for the form of the Langevin equation that I showed at the start. And these are the forms that we've taken. But eventually this leads us to a deterministic partial differential equation, which we can now solve by decomposing the tube into a series of Rouse-like modes. I haven't left the details. I haven't put the details of that in, but if you're interested, it's in the paper. So straight to some calculations now. What I've plotted here is obviously the steady-state shear stress as a function of shear rate, and I put it in comparison to an older version of the theory, which doesn't include chain stretch. So the black curve is a version of theory where the chain retracts instantaneously back to its equilibrium length. And this is some work that was published by Alexei Scott and Tom. And the important point for this model is that there's no shear stress maximum even without chain stretch, and in addition to that, our new version is consistent at rates up until the Rouse time, and then we see a deviation due to chain stretch.
Am I wrong? I see significant contributions of stretch also at very low shear rate.
Bearing
something on the order of say 20%, 30%, even for the long.
Are you talking about this
yeah,
difference?
Is that localized or not? Not totally, not overall.
Probably he used to be different compilation
expression. Oh,
they don't show
it.
No, there's no compilation.
No,
expression. No. I mean, yeah, you do.
Premature effect of stretching.
Yeah, but
no,
I mean, this is understandable because stretching is very strong. Richard, you can say something about the equivalent of beta, as it were, and what values are needed.
Oh, yeah, fair point.
Obviously, there is
the equivalent of beta.
Is mu is equivalent to beta, but the numbers you need without chain stretch are much smaller than the numbers you need in the global theory for beta. So critical
value of our parameter is 4.06. So it's 30 times smaller than your
the critical parameter. But with big data, you actually use
one. One or 0.1, depending. Let's say that different mathematical approximation give you a factor of 30 in this prefactor. So all speculations about 1 or 1.2 for this prefactor is
meaningless.
Yeah, it's quite meaningless.
Okay. So finally, if we want to make a comparison with experimental data, we need to include contour length fluctuations, which is not something which I had in my original Langevin equation. Now, it's actually pretty easy to write down the terms you'd need in the Langevin equation to get what people argue is the right physics. To put that in is straightforward. To solve it is something of a different task. And I haven't actually seen a completely analytic solution to this, even in the linear regime. So I think it's pretty okay to put this in an approximate way. And if anybody wants to show me how to solve this, then great. But the approach we took for this was to say, okay, this is our reputation term. The way we were going to model contour length fluctuations is having a diffusion constant which is dependent on position along the chain, therefore allowing the chain ends to relax faster than the middle. And if we do this by generalizing a contour variable diffusion equation, we produce an expression which looks like this. And we can, from some analytic calculations, we can produce a suggested form for this DCLF, and we finalize the form by insisting that it agrees with Alexei's first passage time simulations in the linear limit. So the idea being that we use what we know to derive a form for this, and use Alexei's simulations to get the prefactors right to ensure that we have the correct linear limit.
One way of doing this might have been you had a random shift, it was R of S plus delta psi.
Yeah.
If you had which was global.
Yeah.
For rotation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had made that delta psi local over about an entanglement length.
Yeah.
Would that correspond to a local D or that's a physical assumption you might have tried.
That's the form that I had in mind when I talked about saying you can modify the Langevin equation.
Okay.
It's you just change the stochastic force which produces reptation to be correlated only on a local scale instead of across the whole.
I think that we came to conclusion that to include contour length reptation in this model, you have to differentiate between tube and chain. So the current model is for tube only. We assume the chain is inside the tube. But to solve for contour length rotations inside this model, you need to watch the chain and to watch the tube separately and solve first passage problem, which is not possible in the terms of these averages.
Okay.
So but even if you just put a local stochastic force in it, still.
I think we've stretched the field around.
If you came to the conclusion, is S a parameter along the, is S a measurement of number of monomers or of primitive pathways?
Number of monomers.
So it's non-uniform monomer density along the
U. Middle of the tube is stretched more than that.
So if you add what you consider the physically reasonable thing, it created a mathematical mess when you tried to close it?
Yeah. Well,
the first passage problem is a very, very complicated problem. So inside this, the first passage problem is solved only for rotation. So it's one-dimensional diffusion equation in absorbing boundary condition. If you want to put contour length rotations, you have to go to n dimensions. So it's and we'll talk about it Friday.
You're not trying to solve the whole first passage problem. You're just trying to get an equation for the moments from an underlying Langevin equation.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was, what happens if you stick in a spatially random displacement rather than a global displacement?
It screws up the mathematics. I can show you why. It's only a few lines. You come to a grinding halt.
It doesn't just correspond to this with a local diffusion.
Sorry?
It's not as simple as this equation with a local diffusivity.
No. So what I've got here are some plots of our tangent correlation function in steady state for a range of different parameters for the model. The thing to note here is that the rate that I've got here is 16 times the rotation time. This is for the non-stretching version of the theory. And C nu is set to 1, which is actually different to beta equals 1. So what we can see is that along the spine, S equals S prime, we have a lot of correlation, and then this falls off fairly rapidly, which is what you would expect, because the fact that the points out here are zero is telling you the one end of the chain is not correlated with the other end, and we get some propagation of the correlation away from the spine due to constraint release, and reptation contour length fluctuations act along the chain. Specifically, contour length fluctuations reduces the correlation in these corners.
This is with the S-dependent diffusion coefficient, right?
Yes, yes.
There's when you have S, the way that you had it written, it's like Klimentovich calls this kinetic interpretation. And there gets to be some subtlety with the Lange-Banach ridge when you pass from the Fokker-Planck, that you get drift terms that show up from derivative diffusion. You guys handled that.
The common length rotation is the only term which we treated after, not in stochastic equation, but in regular equation. But what we did, we checked it that in linear regime, it agrees with exact solution from simulations. Okay? So we adjusted parameters in this different expression from the field equation to the linear.
What we find is once we get into moderately nonlinear flows, then the constraint release becomes much stronger than the contour length fluctuations, particularly in control of the stress. Maybe for more subtleties of this whole 3D function, then maybe you could argue that we need a more rigorous implementation of contour length fluctuations. So this is for a slower rate, with relatively strong CCR. This is in steady state. It's still a non-linear flow. It's flowing at the same time as the reptation time, but we can see that the constraint release kills a lot of the correlations, and this is the reason for losing the shear stress maximum. This one is at a slightly higher rate, so I'm just scrolling through higher rates now. And these are all steady state calculations. And this is without constraint release. You can see the whole thing is a lot more focused. It's pure reptation. Anyway.
Without constraint release, is the width of edge just a numerical artifact? Is it rigorously?
Yeah, it's a delta function in this direction. Because we keep
a
finite number of models.
So I'm going to move on now to talk about how we take this model and compare it to experimental data. We're in a strong situation in that we have now two models which are consistent in the linear regime. We have Alexei's detailed linear model, and then we can pass parameters from that model over to our non-linear model, and this ensures that we have the correct behavior at low rates. So we can pass over the entanglement weights, entanglement modulus, a single time scale is all that we need. And then this constraint release parameter. And what we found is that passing these over is fine. But the linear rheology tends to suggest one set of values for C nu. But if we treat this parameter when we look at the nonlinear flow, we find that the nonlinear rheology suggests that there should be a lower value. One of the explanations for this is that it's related to the argument we were having about whether there's an intrinsic difference between solutions and melts. For example, the solutions typically need much larger values of C nu to fit the value of G double prime. So that's a bit of a mystery at the moment. So these are the comparisons to some data. It's the Menezes and Grassley PBB solutions at a range of different molecular weights. This is using Alexei's theory. These are the best fit values, which suggest that C nu should have a value of 1. And this is what happens if we tweak the value a tiny bit and say the value should be 0.1. So we still have a reasonable fit, but it's not as good as it was before.
Just visually, in other words, you don't do any. When you say you have a better fit or a less good fit,
the rate function is a bit.
That's it. So that's your CNU 1.1.
Even this one's not that bad.
Yeah, that's the point I'm trying to make, is that ideally we maybe want CNU set to 1, but the sensitivity is not so great.
Yeah.
It's well known when you do closures that parameter meanings change. If you take something like the phenine versus the phenine P model, then you get very similar results in LBE. All the parameter values are completely different. Wow. So it's not surprising that the C nu doesn't pass over from one model to another.
Well, not only parameter values, you can also change the whole.
that's right. But even when you don't change those things, the parameter values change.
Okay. So I'll push on to comparison with data. The first thing that I should mention is that there's probably a more serious shift than the need to change C nu. And that what that is we found that there's a difference in the values of the Rouse time that suggested by the linear rheology, and we used to obtain these fits for the nonlinear rheology. I found that I had to shift the Rouse factor down by, sorry, Rouse time roughly by a factor of 4. And what this does now is it gives good agreement across all the rates, apart from a weakness in steady state at the highest rates. We don't currently have an explanation for why we need this factor of 2.
This agreement comes from the stretch curve.
Yeah.
So you over predict the stretch.
Yes, yeah.
Are you shifting the distance between the Rouse and the rotation time, or are you shifting the Rouse and the rotation time together by shifting
only the Rouse time?
Well,
and you're fixing the number of tangents.
We adjust number of entanglement safeties. We adjust prefactor and factor of frustration.
Which
is affecting the Rouse time.
But it looks precisely like something James mentioned, because it's in front of the term which is involved in substantial
closure.
This
is most difficult closure approximation. So we blame this adjustment.
Right.
Closure can be approximated by a factor of 4 in practice.
Maybe. I would say the closure approximation is one possibility. I wouldn't say we're necessarily going to blame it on that, but
it's convenient.
Yes.
Does the Lodge-Meissner rule work in your model?
I have to remind me what that is.
Well, it relates the normal stress to the shear stress, so you can actually experimentally, it's known that you can take the shear stress data and put it on the normal stress data with the Lodge-Meissner rule at the same.
Or the stress data, not for inception.
Steady shear, right? It's for inception.
Well, I thought it worked fine for this.
No,
well,
it
can't
do,
because, for example,
shear stress is
one thing and the other doesn't. So
to be valid, you need a single deformation. Not the mean theory of deformation. A single deformation becomes a theory.
What we find is that shifting this factor of 4 produces good agreement here, and also the normal stresses come without any more tweaking. And then more encouragingly, we can scale this up for a different molecular weight, same series of measurements, but the molecular weights increase by a factor of 3, So everything else is the same, and we've kept this Rouse shift at 4.2. And again, we capture the shear stress reasonably well and the normal stresses. So send me a model that does better.
These results are qualitatively very similar to the reverse and door. The results are very similar. I'm just going to quantitate.
They capture the maximum. And, you know, we wouldn't wave red flags over this other than the physical appropriateness of the molecular detail of the model. They do have, I think, we should capture the shape and the time of the maximum.
So you must be making a mistake on this. You're capturing the maximum beautifully, but then making a mistake on the steady state value?
Yes, at high rates.
Which increases with higher shear rates.
Yes.
Because this is normalized.
So if you get the steady state value right, the overshoot is
They mentioned this number of size of maximum to the platform is too small in our theory. But this overshoot size about 3 in this the fastest shear rate is about 3, so where it is consistent in all experiments, or it's a particular feature of this experiment.
So the next thing that I did was to look at the steady state extensional data that was presented yesterday. Followed exactly the same procedure. And bizarrely enough, a shift of 4.2 and a value of C nu 0.1 gives us this plot.
If you don't do the shift, your curve goes up.
If we don't do the shift, the minimum is here. And
this is no change in parameters from the shear, Richard, is that right?
Well, it's a different material, so it followed the same procedure. Tried it with RS set to 1, doesn't work. Tried 4.2, this is what we get.
It also looks like
Meadlar
syndrome. It looks like you get a slight local maximum.
Oh, I'm not sure whether I should be.
A little bit, yeah.
No. Oh, okay. I hadn't realized that.
At low rates, okay.
I think it's up to.
At low rates, we have 3 times the zero shear viscosity.
Have you ever literally calculated a linear viscoelastic spectrum with a nonlinear model?
No.
Yes.
You guys should work together.
It depends what the meaning of you is.
It depends on how we understand the equation. What we calculated is startup viscosity for very low shear rate from both linear and non-linear.
I assume you're talking about.
Which is the same, which is both of T.
Yeah, you could put an oscillatory strain on it.
Yeah, you can do it.
If you're interested, we did the transients as well. The ones that were, I've got a preprint of your paper.
We're going to get some more transients.
Not on this data, though.
Mm-hmm.
Are you over?
Not quite, but.
When did you finish?
Okay. Well, I just wanted to summarize what I think we have done and what we haven't done. So we do have the molecular base, consistent equation, no shear stress maximum. We can take most of the parameters from the linear rheology, but there are still some issues with this required tweaking. It's not a parameter-free theory at this stage. But the Rouse shift, which seems to be the most problematic one, for all the materials we've tested, which at the moment is not a vast number, but it appears to be independent polymer species and the flow geometry. Oh, and molecular weight as well.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, yeah, for the data we tested so far, but... and also we have this problem with solutions. The G prime data suggests that C nu should be should be larger than money that we need to get better agreement with the.
So that extension thing you showed, what's the new? What's the
point one?
Point one.
Yeah.
How sensitive is it? What happens if you do go back up to the
100
plus
value?
Okay.
The minimum is more bonus.
Yeah.
How many parameters are you actually changing? You're changing
two.
Renewal,
yeah.
And the route time.
Yeah. But I'm arguing that I don't think that I think that the nonlinear data is more sensitive to CNU than the linear. Yeah. If you set it to one, you get a lower value of the.
Goes down further.
Yeah. You get a deeper. Deeper well.
It doesn't depend on the gamma epsilon dot or something.
What doesn't depend?
Well, if you presume that it's supposed to be continuously changing from 1 to 0.1 as you change gamma.
Yes. When you change CNU in the linear theory, it changes the terminal time.
Isn't like the outer left limit of this supposed linear theory?
Yeah.
So isn't if you think of CNU and you round the vector as a parameter that changes continuously, it wouldn't be like a function of those from 1 to 0.1 as you come here? Or should this thing as a just have two step functions to values, or is it a continuous ticking parameter? I thought that I'm asking
you. Not really, no.
You have two parameters in your model, mm-hmm. and in the limit of epsilon dot going to minus to zero, the both parameters are presumably one.
No.
There's
one parameter for the whole curve.
Well, not
for. I think just about to average his last line. It's average his last line. Also, Pino was very.
It's the same for the whole line.
Well, I know how you could use the curve. I'm asking about the physical meaning in the limit. The curve at zero should give you CNU 1, not CNU 0.1. It's not consistent with the linear theory.
So here are some.
Calculating approximation of those is not just one parameter.
Here are some things that I'm thinking about at the moment. I've been asked about the damping function. So that's one thing that I'm going to check. Do we cover the Edwards version or something close to that? Other shear histories. I'd hoped to have some double step shear and change in shear rate calculations. I didn't have time to do those for today, but should have those very soon. We're going to look at some other probes because we're making predictions about a lot more than just the rheology. So it's worth looking at opportunities to test these. So neutron scattering, dielectric NMR data. So these are things that I can do fairly soon. And these are outstanding issues as I see them, which is why do we need to shift the Rouse time? And is there any particular reason why the Rouse time appears to be consistent? Obviously, I'm going to check with some more data sets to find out whether it is consistent over as much of the available data as I can get hold of. And is this related to closure approximations? And are they valid and in which situations? Why do we overpredict steady-state shear stress? And finally, I think to answer quite a lot of these, we need to resolve the issues with what's happening with CNU for solutions. Is there some missing physics there?
Just one comment is that the fact that you, whatever shifts you have to make in this Rouse time, are the same for shear flow and extensional flow.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that the validity of the closure approximation would have a strong sensitivity basically to that transition. So if you don't have to make any switch in the Rouse time, that's a good sign.
Is it a good sign or a bad sign?
You can't probably blame the closure, is what I would say. There was some other reason for the.
Can you go back a moment to those slides showing the correlation F of S and S prime?
Yeah, sure.
Three-dimensional plots.
Hang on a moment. Yeah, sure.
when you have shown the one at I shear rate, where the correlation is clearly lost because of convective cosmetic
impact. Yep. That's this one.
Yeah. Now, my question is the following. Shouldn't you recover in some limit close to the one you're showing the correlation of the Rouse change? At least to some length scale. Because when the mobility of the surroundings becomes so fast, then you should recover the intrinsic connectivity of the chain and find the F function for the Rouse chain.
Are you speaking about fast flow?
Fast flow.
This flow.
Yes.
This flow.
Oh, it's.
You want to go to.
Oh, okay, so we got we do have.
This is local. This is when CCR is important, isn't it?
Yeah.
So my point is when CCR is important, you should recover the correlation of the Rouse chain.
This
not exactly because it keeps retracting, right? This retraction is also very strong, so it's not exactly a Rouse dynamics. It's a Rouse dynamics of constant length.
Okay.
Well, but which is so Rouse retracting chain, it keeps stretching and retracting. So it's quite different from Rouse.
But on some length scale, you should be recovering that because you have no time to feel that
exactly.
Essentially, some length scale correlated to the rapidity of the renewal, you should recover the Rouse correlation. So my suggestion would be to calculate the Rouse correlation to make a comparison. Because that teaches something about the model anyhow.
If the retraction is instantaneous, then it's not necessarily local. Right? That is, if you're at an intermediate shear rate where you're treating the retract, you're treating it as a rigid, an inextensible rope, then it means everything's globally coupled by retraction.
Yeah, but I mean, the real physics would be that you don't feel that on some length scale.
Retraction is very strong. In high shear rates, retraction is very strong.
But retraction is Rouse.
Yeah, but these are intermediate rates, so it's a highly entangled chain. The Weissenberg number with reputation is high, but the Weissenberg number against Rouse is small.
So there's no stretch in this.
Yeah,
no stretch. No chain stretch. So it really can't be
but quite. Even if this stretch, the retraction is weaker than complete, but it's still
this
very,
be,
very strong.
This should be Weissenberg number based on Rouse. I know that too.
Well, no, this is a version of theory which.
Well, my physics suggests me, I may be wrong, that when the surroundings moves very fast, the entanglements should not count anymore.
Right, the question how fast? Whether it's Rouse time or tau e. So at
now,
tau e, clearly, every few seconds,
you can make gamma dot as large as you want. Right?
How?
And also the molecular weight as large as you want, so as to separate the two times as much as you want.
Okay.
And then there will be a regime where the surroundings move fast enough with respect to levitation that local motions of the Rouse are recovered.
Is
it a Rouse model?
No.
That's not clear.
In the Rouse model, no. You should compare Rouse time of CCR Rouse time with shear rate, right? And if you write down equations, then you never achieve this. You achieve it only at tau e. So you have to constraints have to disappear really fast to achieve this regime then where you don't
amplify on that a little bit. Just remember that the CCR rate for chains that are reasonably well aligned is basically the shear rate. Okay? But that's the rate at which you make one pop. Alright? So if you were to estimate the Rouse time for the whole tube based on that, it's not the shear rate, it's n over ne squared bigger than that. And it remains so no matter what the shear rate is. So what's the rate you have to get at before you never lose the importance of retraction.
So the retraction is important because it renews the surrounding.
Yes, but if retraction is of order of Rouse time, as you postulate, you have to multiply it by z squared.
That's the Rouse time of the old thing.
Yes.
And what I'm saying is that locally, yeah, that rapid motion of the surround is related to the
locally, that's true.
Locally,
that's why this peak problem is in the channel.
Yeah, but that, what I'm saying is that eventually you should recover
Individually. That's in the county.
I feel we're being evicted, folks. The other program was sticking to me. I appreciate it. Can we just thank some of the contributors again?